preview. I understand I'll be saying a few things, and then you'll be splitting into groups, as I have been given to understand that this is the pattern for at least the DFP meetings. And you'll be spending time in these groups discussing some questions, and we conclude by coming together again and the feedback of the respective groups. The event is planned to end 5:15. I shortened our sitting a little bit to give our discussional part more space, because I think that is the weight of the day. I'll be with you after you've been in groups. It doesn't make sense that you discuss in groups in English, and just to keep me in, so it's best if you do these groups in Hebrew, and I'd be happy if some of the feedback could be back in English maybe at the end of it, if that's okay with you. Good. First, is there anything that needs clarifying from this morning?
I don't know if it ties in, or maybe I missed it, but there was a first part where you discussed the Buddhist practice that might go in the small or the big picture, and one can get lost either way. And then you discussed about the relationship we have with the world on the thinking mind level or on the feeling heart level. And I missed the connection between the two parts. Or was there a connection between the two parts?
Well, there is. Obviously, the connection between the analytical part and the synthetic part is, they're both unavoidable. So both taken by exclusion are not going to help, because they lead to a result that we cannot reconcile with our immediate empirical experience. The second part, about the two main pillars of the Buddhist teaching, namely wisdom, which provides insight, which provides liberation, and compassion. They relate very well, because once you start developing insight, you will become aware of things that are not flattering to yourself. You will need a lot of compassion to be able to hang out with what you have started to gain insight in. So if it is just wisdom, it is very dry. And it is a type of understanding that tends to be head-centered. It's very difficult to establish value on the wisdom level. For the value level, we need the heart. So one of the fundamental ways we establish an interconnectedness on a heart level is compassion. And in some way, like the first two pillars, the analytical and the synthetical, are both taken at an extreme, are both not useful. The wisdom level on its own is going to make you very dry, possibly cynical. You know it all and you don't do anything about. The compassion level is very likely to make you connected to others, to make you go in resonance, to tremble with others, but you don't have any ground to stand on. Your action is not based on an understanding of things. So you're likely to get lost. So I think the connection, and maybe I haven't stated that clearly, is we need to identify A, what these things are, then B, what kind of type we are. We have tendencies. Most of us are either more empathetically connected, or we're more wisdom oriented. We're more analytically minded, or we're more synthetically minded. Generally, we have a choice in there. Maybe even not a conscious choice, but we favor one aspect. So we, I think, need to establish that these things go in pairs, and then we need to find out what we usually do, and obviously make the necessary corrections. Am I answering to your question?
Yes, yes. I realized the Karuna thing ties. So it's like standing on both feet.
Yes.
One foot is the more wisdom that comes from, in sense, an analytical process.
can be. Most of wisdom is also intuitive, but it doesn't necessarily follow from you understanding something that you feel connected with it.
Yeah, like the small bits or the big picture, all that.
Yes, you need to do both routes. There is no way. You know, if you climb the mountain up this way, you need to climb the mountain down the other way.
And then the other one is just working with the heart, with the karuna, will not give you a context to operate in.
Yes, and worse, just by resonating with others, you may lose the perspective of wisdom. You know, you may get washed away by... It's good to be able to hold a heart connection. At the same time, you don't necessarily help other people by becoming sad with them when they're sad, or becoming euphoric when they become euphoric. Mm. Yeah. You need the capacity to do that, to be able to resonate with happiness, with sadness, with grief, with anger, with loss, with despair. You need to somehow have a heart capacity to connect with this. But at the same time, you need the wisdom perspective, otherwise you're just going to join in, you know? Now, we have a tendency to experience these things as mutually exclusive. My background favors insight, it favors head, it favors individualism, it favors analytical process. Yeah. So part of my path has been to do the opposite. First, obviously you choose what you like, you know. Your choices are always what you already know. You choose that. Then it takes you a few years, once you've done that, you find out actually why you have chosen. You find out that the reason you have chosen this is not because this is what you need, but that this is what you're already familiar with. Now, if you're in a good tradition, then you will have the chance to do the opposite. If the tradition is really genuine, then it will have enough of the opposite for you to reorient. So you go away from the analytical, insight-oriented, and actually start developing your relationship. That is the connection. And generally we correct too much, you know, we do enough. It's like on a boat. You've been on a boat? You have a tiller here?
I've been many times.
Yeah, so if you hold out the rudder till it's enough, you're too far.
Yes.
You know, you have to stop. I think you got me.
Mm-hmm.
Good. Please.
Yeah, about the experience of thought, like, I see that most of the time it's like a voice or something that can be expressed in words or sentences, but sometimes it also go into the form of images. And I have a lot of occasion in meditation that I get into real distorted kind of images. So I'm not sure I'm thinking these images. It's not, even if it's not a wise or insightful thought. This is really goes somewhere into the, I don't know, dreaming realm area. So was wondering what is your take about what is considered as thought and what is not in the
You have to understand, the Buddha doesn't think in terms of thought. If you look at his teaching, he speaks of, it's good to use the framework of the Satipatthana Sutta. Yeah, first you have kaya and upasana, body sensation. Now, whatever people tell you, first Satipatthana is about how the body feels. It's sensation. It's not feeling, it's not emotion, it's not anything, it's sensation. Warmth, pressure, tension, fullness, aliveness, vitality, tingling of ants, this kind of thing. Second category is what you like and you don't like about your experience. It's something we don't have a word for. You've been with me at the Bhavana house. I've talked about Vedana. Quality of Vedana is the lust, the interest factor, the lust factor, the pleasure factor, the satisfaction factor, yes, no, on, off. So the second category is the second big foundation for mindfulness. The third is actual emotion, citta. It's the state of mind. And the fourth, that's where your question fits in, is both thought and image. This is the raw material. In fact, it's patterned thought and patterned image. Yeah? Dhammanupassana is the content of mind. Now, that content may be visual, it may be more discursive. That happens to be dependent on your type. If you're curious about the wholesome or unwholesome quality of these contents, you have to look what they do with you. If they make you more clear, if they make you more compassionate, if they make you more decisive, if they make you more calm, then they're generally wholesome. If they make you more confused, more anxious, more agitated, more guilty, then they're generally not healthy. Now, some of what you describe may just be simple dreamy moments. You know, you drift off and you go into sort of a dreamy, hazy pattern. For me, the experience is if you kind of, it's like driving and suddenly your horizon starts to go a little funny, you know? It's as if you used to drive on the road and suddenly it feels as if you're flying. Yeah? That's an example. Your artificial horizon goes a bit hobbly. You have to identify where these things come from. You know, mind has many layers. Sometimes things come up. Some of these things have value. They tell you something about yourself. Some of these things are distractions. Some of these things are little dramas you make up.
Can you tell?
You have to find out what they do to you. You tell by their fruits. I cannot give you recipes. I mean, we end up being our own experts, but there are some telltale signs, the ones I've just said. You know, if you gain some insight, then generally this is useful. If you just find yourself confused or angry, or if you find yourself getting greedy or lustful or despondent or so, they're probably not useful. I would also try, whenever you're in doubt, try to establish a clarity what this is. Is this a thought? Is this an image? Is it an emotion? Is it a vedana? Is it just something that likes or doesn't like? Is it a body sensation? That you get these four categories are very helpful to establish, you know, what am I actually dealing with right now? Is this the state of the world or is this the state of the mind? Now, ultimately, these things cannot be taken apart. You understand, every aspect of our experience has all four. Every aspect of experience has a body component. Every aspect of experience is being rated as pleasant or unpleasant in a subtle or not so subtle way. Every aspect of experience is followed or accompanied by a mind state. Every aspect of experience has a mental or an image, a visual component. So it's crucial. We cannot dissect this, but we can choose particular perspectives. So we're interested in the emotional side of things, or we're interested in the cognitive side of things. We're interested in the feeling side of things. We're interested in the body side of things. Now generally, for meditation aspects, it's crucial that you come back to body. How does this feel right now here in the body? If you're not sure what the quality of phenomenon is you're dealing with, go back to the body. Do you have a body reference? Is mindfulness in the body there? Can you ground yourself? Can you center yourself? Can you put yourself in the middle? This kind of thing. And then you look at this. Is it addictive? Does it suck you in? Or does it pull you away? Is it easy going close or not? You know, you start checking out the space around it. This is not always easy, and you keep an axis, you keep a ground, you keep your weight, you keep what you say in the car, you keep your wheels on the ground. Yeah? It's okay to drive fast, keep your wheels on the ground.
Yeah. You were saying that every mental experience has both imagery and discursive?
Generally, not both, but at least one. You know, there's things you just, where you just dream, where it's just image. Yeah, and then there's moment there is no images, it's just talk. But there is always an aspect of either, sometimes both. Now, we experience any moment these four categories, and you could zap, you know, like with the TV, you can change channels. Okay, what's going on? Body. Reasonably relaxed, left shoulder a bit hot. Yeah. Zap, Vedana. Do I like this? Yes, it's pleasant. Peaceful. Interesting. Zap, state, mind state. Awake, tea helps. Curious. Tendency definitely positive. Zap, next channel, Dhammanupassana, what's going on? Images, these chokaranda trees, wonderful. Then thinking, what is relevant? Time is running out. What is relevant now? Yeah, I can. So we can do that. Now, most of the time we're not conscious that we can change channel. Most of the time we're stuck in channel 4, thinking. Yeah? Now, this is generally not a useful channel for if you're angry. Or it's not a useful channel if we're afraid. Yeah? You cannot make the mind be peaceful by being, by thinking about anger. It makes the mind a lot more peaceful by keeping the attention here and waiting till it stops, till it goes quiet, or go back to the breath. The same, we cannot make the mind peaceful when it is afraid by thinking about fear, or by thinking about the thing that makes us fearful. So it's better to take the attention away from the mind, back into the heart, and say, this is fear, this is trembling, this is butterflies in my belly. Yeah? And if we're willing to hold that, to bear that, you will notice that the experience is transformed more quickly. It's not more nice, but it's going to pass faster. If we think about it, we tend to split off, and at the same time we conserve the experience. So the fear will not become resolved, the anger will not become resolved. We've learned to distance a little bit, at the same time we're feeding. You know, one hand is holding at a distance, the other hand is feeding the animal. Yeah. Please?
If you have a tendency to be more in the wisdom part, more than in the heart part, how, which ways you recommend to encourage yourself to be more to the compassionate side?
Put yourself in other people's place. Connect with your own suffering and see the suffering in other people. Recognize how other beings seek happiness and fear pain. Put yourself in their position. What is painful for her? What is painful for him? What is he afraid of? Yeah? Particularly important to do with people whom you don't like. We are most callous, we are most blunt, we are most thick-skinned with people whom we don't like. The people whom we like, we feel with. If they have pain, we relate to their pain. The people whom we don't like, generally we don't let them close enough for us to feel their pain. A very powerful way of relating to pain, seeing the painful aspect in things, looking at somebody and rather than envying how good they have it, look at their pain. What is hurtful in their lives? What didn't work out? What did they try? Do you know their suffering? There's plenty of suffering to be connecting to.
You have a tip. How can you protect yourself when you do decide compassion and to understand other people's suffering. People that maybe you suffer from them. How you protect yourself to understand them, feel their suffering, and still protect yourself from them, because sometimes it can turn to feeling that you understand them and they like take advantages of that. I don't know if I'm clear. You understand what I mean? Like, is it clear, the question?
Yeah, I think the question is clear.
You can sink into it and it happens to me sometimes that I, let's say, I apologize to somebody, not from a place of understanding that we both made a mistake. Then the other person can say, yes, you, it's right, you was wrong, and thank you for your apologize, for example. So how can you protect yourself from that?
Well, you see, the willingness to feel other people's pain is directly opposed to protecting yourself. You have to choose. If you feel other people's pain, you feel their pain. You feel the pain like they feel the pain. It doesn't mean that they're right and you're wrong. You don't need to accept their interpretation of what's happening. You can still connect to their pain. It's maybe better to think of, rather than protecting yourself against them, is of holding the truth of your own experience. You're capable in your heart, you know, if you feel somebody's pain, it means you make space. Something in your heart opens and you let these people in and you offer them some space in your heart so that your body and your being starts to reverberate with what they feel. Now this is risky. This is exactly the opposite from protecting. Now that doesn't mean you say everything they do or say is right. It just means you feel for them. Obviously you can only do that if you feel yourself, you know, if you're prepared to do that to yourself, with yourself. Otherwise you'd just be washed away with their suffering. You just turn into a trembling mess. And you cannot be really of much use, neither to themselves nor to yourself. There's just two people suffering rather than one. You have to be at home in yourself. You have to be at home in your own heart to be able to offer some of that heart. But it is the very opposite of protecting yourself. But you can learn to distinguish what is pain and what is interpretation, what is value judgment, what is attribution of guilt. Now, just because you're willing to feel somebody's pain, you don't need to accept their interpretation, you don't need to accept their worldview, you don't need to accept their guilt trips or their blaming trips. You can communicate that. You know, people, particularly people close to you, they will notice when they reach your heart. They will listen, they will talk more softly, it will arrive. And that doesn't mean they're right. It just means you feel their pain. And there's something in human beings that happens when we recognize each other's pain. Maybe more profound than we recognize each other's happiness. It's amazing how much happiness we can share without connection. And it's amazing how deep connecting goes when we share pain. So whoever you think of, I'm sure he or she will understand. And she will also, or he will also understand that doesn't necessarily mean that they are right across the board and you are not.
Yeah. I have a question for you. Question, the suggestion for the group. Personally, I would prefer to sit in this relatively small group and share our thoughts and remarks with you since you are here, instead of clinging to our ways.
What is that way?
I don't know how the group feels.
Instead of creating dukkha, you know.
Very subtly put. look, this is your day, isn't it? At least some of you are part of the DFP program. How many, actually? You have to decide. I'm happy to do either way. I'm also happy to drink a cup of tea and let you discuss. And
we can do it while drinking tea.
Maybe we can do one circle with you and do it in English.
That's what I was.
So maybe we sit in a circle, because for me at least.
Yeah,
that's
okay.
Well, good. Good. Can I say something small to follow on from that?
Mm-hmm. Whoops.
Are you on track?
Yeah, on.
I wanted to share with you a couple of qualities in the Buddhist teaching that come up again and again. Some of those qualities are quite famous, others are not. The Buddha has established communities. He spoke of four groups of people, four parisa, four communities. Community of laymen, laywomen, community of monks and nuns. He spoke of four parisas, and he addressed, during 45 years of teaching, he addressed all four. So much of his teaching is directed to people who are not living monastic lives. It's crucial for me to say that. There's some space over here. You can come over here. The first four qualities are what he calls the Brahma Vihara. You heard of this, the divine abidings, the immeasurables. They have two names. One is Appamanyas, means the immeasurable states. The other is the Brahma Viharas, which means the states like Brahma gods experience them. Buddha was speaking to a community of people that was familiar with a mythical worldview, and divine states were something that meant a lot to people of his time. You're in the sun, huh?
It's okay.
Maybe we could. I could sit here and we'll turn around.
Someone will be here. It's okay.
We can open here a little more.
Look, if I turn around a bit and I sit like this, then you can sit into the shadow. So I trust you're familiar with the Brahma Vihara, yeah? Metta, loving kindness, karuna, compassion, mudita, either joy or sympathetic joy, upekkha, equanimity. These are generally states well known, and there are specific meditation practices associated with those four states. I'd like to suggest an understanding of those four states that isn't just meditation exercise. These are not just meditation exercises, which we do. May all beings in the northerly direction have loving kindness. May all beings in the northeasterly direction have loving kindness. Yeah, there is that kind of that type of exercise in the commentarially based methodical teachings of meditation. But if you look at the Buddhist teaching, he presupposes these four experiences of metta, karuna, mudita, upekkha. He presupposes those as fundamental states of the heart, of the mind. They are there if the mind is not troubled. It's not just something we produce through meditation. It's something that comes up from below. It's something that is part of a free human heart. Yeah. So it's something we have all access to. They are not just products of meditation that we have to produce It's something that we can let through from underneath. That's important to see. They're often misunderstood. And if you're not feeling particularly loving, kind to your neighbors, you sense you don't have this. The truth is you do have it, but it is latent. Wow. These four states are underpinning all relationship. Yeah. They are crucial. And they are states of connectedness. Every one of them is a state of connectedness.
Can you repeat again the four states?
Loving kindness, called metta or maitri. Karuna, compassion, or trembling along, the old word, remember, anukampa. Then mudita, which is joy, or sympathetic joy. Sometimes the joy at seeing goodness in yourself, that's recognizing goodness in yourself. Yeah, that's when it is joy. Recognizing goodness when it is in others, that means sympathetic. It means like compassion. You go along with somebody's joy. So like you go along with somebody's pain. And the fourth state is equanimity. Now, all of those states are still states of connectedness. Yeah, they are relational. They have a basis in the way we live our relationship. Equanimity doesn't mean indifference. It doesn't mean we don't care, everything's fine. Yeah. It means we recognize that what happens to you has its own history in your karmic stream. It has its own causes and conditions. Some of those are obvious to me, some of those are not. Some of those are obvious to you, some are not. There is something that takes place. I can see the surface of the picture, but not necessarily all. And I'm, to some degree, equanimous. Now, it's important for those qualities to see those in ourselves. It's important not just to think this is something we should do. Yeah, it's important to actually acknowledge when these happen, when the mind is in these frames. That's the first thing. We identify the parts in which we already resemble a truth or a quality, a virtue, a skill. We have to recognize where it is there, even in very small, in seed form. That's the first thing. We are not totally strange from what we should do. Enlightenment is not something totally alien to us. You know, they say we have to acknowledge our intelligence, our capacity for loving kindness, for compassion, for joy and sympathetic joy, and for equanimity. These are generally considered to be individual qualities. There's four other big qualities which the Buddha uses, and they are the basis for social harmony. And they are a lot less known. They're called Sangaha Vattu. The only meaningful translation I know of is either basis for sympathy or basis for social harmony. These are sometimes related to those four Brahma Viharas. The Buddha says that we cultivate these states, and this is what is harmony building. This is what makes community. One of them is generosity. It's that we are generous with our energies, our time, our money, with our strength, with our skills. We invest, we give of ourselves. That's the direct opposite of attachment. You notice? You know? The primary movement of generosity, by the way, that's the way Buddhism starts. He didn't say you have to meditate. He didn't even, yeah? You take refuges and you practice generosity. That's a crucial statement to make. So, generosity doesn't just mean you give food to monks, like sometimes in Asian countries this is practiced, or you build temples for them. Or you do some special event for your dead parents once a year or so. Generosity means you put your energies to the things you feel you have established as value. Earlier on I spoke of identifying values, what matters in our life. You start putting your energy there. Yeah. You don't wait till the perfect group comes along. You start making the group perfect you're in, even if you don't think this is the perfect group. Yeah. You don't say, I'm waiting till the right movie comes. This is the wrong movie. Please give me the right movie. Yeah? The movie you're in is the right movie. This is crucial. So if you're not happy with that movie, make that movie better. put your chips on that movie, because that's the movie that's happening. That's crucial. If you're not happy with the marriage you're in, make that marriage better. If you're not happy with the place you live, make that place better. If you're not happy with the community, the country, the government, make these things better. Yeah. If it doesn't work, you'll find out early enough. So, first of them is giving. The direct opposite of attachment. You notice we have identified attachment, upadana, as a major problem. It's the major psychological action which creates self. Second one is in Pali called piyavaja. It means delightful speech. It means speech that endears the heart. You actually gain sympathy, you gain social harmony by speaking in a way that is inviting. It's very simple. You know, you don't have to be smarmy or flattering, but you have to be inviting. And so much about our life and our self-understanding has to do with welcoming, welcoming things. And the other big half is letting go of things. Yeah. But first we resist things coming, and then we resist things going. So much of our lives seem to consist of our resistance against either letting in or letting go. So, piyavaja is the second basis for social harmony. A third one, very, very interesting, is attacharya. You do things. You maintain a conduct for doing things. You create, you manifest, you engage, you involve yourself. Yeah. You go into a mode of action. You put your energy out and you practically do things. Again, obviously, that refers to the value you have established. It refers to the community you're in. It refers to the people you feel yourself connected. It refers to what matters to you. So you do things. You do useful things. You see, in one way, that's very opposite from sitting on your cushion and just waiting till mind states unravel themselves and you have perfect insight. And the truth is, we oscillate in our lives, isn't it? We cannot just think, stay on a thinking level, because our lives have other faculties. We cannot just stay in direct experience and not have a single thought about it. We have to keep going back. We are experiencing with our senses, and then we try to make sense of what we experience. We go into a level of abstraction. Neither of them is particularly good or bad. We cannot get out of any of them. We move. The more we are in immediate experience, the more direct it gets. But we cannot speak there. We cannot think there. We cannot reflect. We're just in it. Yeah? It's like a fever. You're in it. Or anger. You're in it. The more you're in, the less you can say about it. The whole world seems to be this, you know, speechless suchness. As soon as you start thinking about it, you get more and more clear. You know, you can be more and more sharp, you can be more and more precise, and yet you are increasingly away from it. Yeah? The clearer you can be, the more you can speak about it, the further away you are from the immediate ground experience, you know, the speechless suchness of it. You understand this? Now, we cannot choose. What we can is move better back and forth. Know when we're here that we're here, when we're there that we're there. The same introspective practice, meditation, is necessary. This is the laboratory situation for understanding our own patterns. What's happening here? This is the major job. If you run a retreat, you turn 90% of your attention in here. 10% you give to when to the loo, when the bell, who's on the washing up, yeah? But 90% goes in here on a retreat. But if you're not in a retreat, you will not be able to maintain 90% of your attention in introspective ways. Your boss will not like that. Your children will not like that. Your lovers will not like that. Yeah? We need to be able to shuttle, to commute. Same story. Attacharya is out, is doing, is action, manifestation, involvement. Yeah. Vipassana practice is the opposite. It's introspective practice. We need to move between these two. And one of the problems with Buddhism in the West is people pick up individual bits of the teaching and they make a lot of them and then they leave the rest there. Yeah? Then after a while you find out that actually this is only a very small part of the teaching. So the teaching of the Buddha also speaks of those bases for harmony. The fourth, by the way, and then I'll end, is called Samanatata, which means impartiality. It means also that we meet others at eye level. We are willing to recognize other human beings on peer level. Yeah. Very, very crucial thing. The Buddha was a great democrat in his take. He favored a little realm to the north of where he spent most of his time, which was called the Vajjayan Republic. That's the 6th century BC. And you have a constitutional republic in those days with a king that had a whole ministry of people which he needed to consult. And he had some powers, but he needed to consult mostly. So the Vajjayan republics were a very unusual social or political form for the 5th century BC. And the Buddha overtly favored this political setup. In fact, when he founded his monastic discipline, he modeled his monastic discipline on the very virtues he felt these political communities had. So he established consultative democracy. Now, in a monastic order, a majority decision comes about 4 steps down. You know, the top one is always consultative democracy. Now, if you've ever tried to do anything like this, unanimous consultation, you will notice that once you have 7 people, you never, ever agree on one thing. You know it's very hard work, and it doesn't work above 7. But there is a deep valuing of the process towards that. That seems to empower group members because it meets people at eye level. Yeah. So impartiality, samanatata, meeting people at eye level, doing a work that takes the other at the same level as you are. Not easy. So I'd like to just put those 4 things in together with the 4 Brahma-Vihara, who are more individual qualities. You have these 4 Sangha-Havatus, which are more social virtues. And in the Buddha's eyes, they together create the basis for community. Yeah, that much from me. Yeah? Please?
I want to add one more remark to the last remark I made in the last session and to ask a question.
Please.
I spoke then on in terms of able to make choices.
Yep.
And actually this perception is very consistent.